Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to my talk. I know it's the last one of the day, and you guys probably saw a lot of interesting stuff already. This is a talk about the journey of UniPlaces, where I work, where we had to scale our dev environments from, well, from the single instance that we had to develop into multiple dev environments, and then into one again. So this is a story about UniPlaces Playground, which is our project that actually achieved that. So this is a slide with a lot of stuff. So these are some of the beautiful companies on which I've worked. Currently, I'm now the lead DevOps engineer at UniPlaces. Does anybody know what a DevOps do? Yes? Yeah, it's more or less within the statistic, like two or three people kind of know it. And yeah, basically, I'm the lead DevOps engineer there. I just giving you a brief introduction of what the DevOps do. I think it can be quickly summarized as making developers successful and operations successful. So we don't work for ourselves, we work for others. And here you guys also have my contacts, my Twitter, my GitHub accounts. And I'm also at PTNet. I don't know if you guys ever used it. It's Internet Relay Chats. No, maybe one person. It's good. It's still within the statistics of people knowing what DevOps is. So it's still the only anonymous way to still communicate, truly anonymous. So let's get started. So what's and why's? So what's a dev environment? So basically, a dev environment, it's a computer system that allows for a computer program or software to be deployed and be executed. And this is just from Wikipedia. And Wikipedia has a really long article on this. So not wanting to take a lot of time with that, I just took a brief summary of what I think are the most important points for this. So basically, a dev environment, it's an environment that contains all your tools and integrations that you need to develop. It also allows for you to, if you want, to make changes to your codes and develop there. It allows you to, as you know, to test your code with confidence, because you know that the dev environment usually should be close to production as possible. So whatever you're developing there, you know that when it gets into production, as you test it locally on your dev environment, it will be probably will be okay. And then why would you need a dev environment? Because you can just develop locally on your machine and compile there if you're using a strongly typed language that needs compilation. But there are some points on why you might need one. So basically, if you have a development environment that has a lot of moving pieces, it's important to have everything all together. So basically, a dev environment allows and or activates developers to efficiently and quickly develop code without worrying with all the hassles of what's not related to the code that you're working on. It also eliminates development frustrations, because typically a dev environment should be something that you just spin up and work on. So you don't need to worry about all the dependencies for your project that are related to infrastructure. Any other frustration that might arise from it not working when you spin it up, or not being compatible with whatever you're working on. And also increases the code that the confidence that your code will behave as expected when shipped. But there are some common problems with dev environments. And I was actually doing some slides just like these, some bullet points, but people told me maybe you should put some images, and I added some. So this is basically one of the major errors that we have, the major problems that we have, which is it can be very error prone. As we have many moving parts, sometimes when you just add that extra piece, everything can fall apart. So it's very tricky to have, for example, a lot of projects running simultaneously, moving from one project to another, and error prone is always there. It's probably the worst one. Another one that probably might frustrate a lot of people when working with dev environments is complexity. So imagine that you guys are developers, and you might be even junior or mid-level developer, and you never worried about where your code actually runs. So if you go and look into it, it might be really complex. It might be something like this. It goes round and round and round, and you have a lot of tiny pieces, and you need to try and understand them, what they do all together, and it's just very, very hard. So for example, if you use virtual machines to configure every project and it has different setups, it might be very hard to not only to set it up, but also to troubleshoot it. And you'll suffer from that. The next one is actually resources. So dev environments can be very resource intensive, as I'll show you guys in a little bit. So you guys might have like this really big machine, but you're consuming it wrong. So you have a lot of resources that are not being properly used. There are problems with bandwidth, as you can see here as well. And it also leads to longer setup periods, which is also something that you guys won't like. Because if you take 3 hours to set up an environment, you don't want it to take 3 hours again. Not even the initial 3 hours. And the last one that I think is very interesting is about onboarding. So the definition of onboarding is bringing a new joiner up to speed with something, right? So there can be problems with onboarding. So you just try to catch it, but it's really slow. For example, we used to have a problem in which developers would take up to 3 hours per project to be able to launch their dev environment on which they would work. They would also take a lot of time to switch between projects or get context on a project because the dev environment wasn't available. And these are pretty much the main problems that we can identify. So the first big question that we have is, why would we have a local dev environment and not a remote one? Or why would we have a remote dev environment and not a local one? So all of them, both of them have its pros and cons. I wouldn't say that you need one versus the other. In my opinion, in my experience, you can always use local dev environments until you go to the point on which you cannot support it anymore because you don't have enough resources, even though they're optimized. Let's say that you start with a monolithic block and you start breaking it into projects or different microservices, and having it all locally might be a really pain in the ass, might be really bad. So I just made this quick chart on which I tried to explain some of the advantages and disadvantages on them. So for example, locally, it's really, really hard to scale a dev environment. And why is that? It's because resources on your laptop are finite, right? So you know you have a specific amount of RAM, you have a specific amount of hard drive, but if you run out of it and you still want to launch something, an extra dev environment, you just won't be able to because you probably need to upgrade your memory, you need to upgrade your hard drive, you're gonna lose all of your data, the IT guy won't do backups, and then it's just, you're gonna end up crying and have a hard time. Well, for example, if you have a remote environment, it's very easy. You can scale whatever remote environment you have vertically, so just increase it to the next big thing that you want it to be, and it's really easy. Locally, it's very less restrictive, so your computer is your own. You can do whatever you want. No one tells you what to do. You work the way you want, as long as you can work on your code, right? Remotely, it's a different story. Guys like me tend to be a little bit of restrictive when it comes to have something on a server, because I don't want you to run your stuff as super user. I want everything to have proper permissions. I only want to run a specific set of applications. And if you guys want to run an extra application, let's say you're using NPM and now you want to use Bower or something like that, if I have a security-enhanced Linux, for example, you guys will need to ask me permission for that. And that's just going to create frustration. Locally, you guys can also develop offline. There are still a lot of people developing offline while remote. You always need to have an active internet connection. It's easier to troubleshoot locally and it's isolated, while on remote, it's hard to troubleshoot. And it can be overlapping with other developers, other projects that are running there. Resources are going to be shared, so you never know if it's going to be fast or not. So both of them has their cons and pros, pros and cons. And this talk is mostly about the local side of it, of this story. So this brings us up to UniPlace's dev involution. basically, this is just a story about how UniPlace's went from the monolithic block that we started breaking down into projects into having a specific mindset for the dev environment up until what we have today. And especially this change was made in 2016, so the story covers it from the end of 2014 to 2016. So UniPlaces in 2014. So UniPlaces in 2014 were around, it was a small team, even though it was already a really big project. And UniPlaces decided to hire an extra developer, a new developer to join the team. And they hired Miguel. So Miguel is nowadays he's head of technology at UniPlaces, which means he does a lot of hacks, he tries a lot of new stuff. But when he joined, he joined as a full stack developer, and he was intended to work on UniPlaces core. So this is a very rough diagram of what UniPlaces had back then, and just to provide you a little bit of context, most startups, and UniPlaces is still a startup, starts with a minimal viable product, which means that you just have a really small piece of code that does whatever value proposition you're trying to put out. But as you start developing, that base code starts growing up, and this is pretty much what we call a monolith, which is a really big project that has a lot of stuff that probably can be broken down into their specific domains, so either projects or microservices. And Miguel is hired to work on UniPlaces core, and when he gets there, this is pretty much what we had in the backend. Most of these technologies are still there. So basically, we're on the web track of these of the Microsoft Open Source Camp, so this is mostly related to the web part of things, to web development. And Miguel started working with PHP and Symfony, and he also had Nginx to serve all the Nginx to serve all the all the requests that he is doing on his work. And he also needs to work a little bit with the data layer that we had at the time, which had Redis, MySQL, DynamoDB, a little bit of Sphinx as well for search. And he's really happy about it, because he's like, okay, I'm joining these really cool products, I have a lot of cool technologies, and how do we develop? Where's my dev environment? And this is the dev environment that we had there. I don't know if you guys watched the other talks of today, but there were a lot of people talking about Ansible, about Vagrant, a little bit as well of VirtualBox. But I'm just gonna provide you guys with a little bit of context for all of this, for all of you that don't know. So this is VirtualBox, and this VirtualBox is an appliance that allows you to run a virtual machine. Does everybody know what a virtual machine is? You guys are familiar with that. Cool. So, but VirtualBox is really cool because it has a very simple interface, but still, you don't want to turn out the graphic user interface every time you want to make a setting, right? So there are these guys. So these guys, this is a product from AshCorp, which is called Vagrant. A Vagrant basically allows us to provision virtual machines in a programmatic way. So it's very easy to create configurations that you can reproduce. It's very easy to change small configs without needing to go to the graphic user interface. You can use the Vagrant files to be, for example, templated or parameterized in another way. And it saves a lot of time regarding configuration of the virtual machine. And now this is Ansible. This was the other part of the stack, which basically, Ansible, what it does, it configures the operating system that's launched on your VM, right? So it's a configuration manager. Same as Vagrant, it allows for programmatically set up your operating system. It has a very easy syntax. You can do it in an imperative way, so it's very easy to be introduced into Ansible. It doesn't need an agent to run. As long as you have SSH to the machine or a way to log into the machine, it will be able to configure it. And there's a lot of people contributing actively to the community, which makes it easier for whenever you guys want to launch, let's say, configure a MySQL server, you just grab it from the community, makes a little bit of configuration, and it's done. So basically, this is what we had back then. We had Vagrant, Ansible running on VirtualBox. There's also a good thing to this, which is this can be stored in the version control system. So you guys can always version it accordingly on every project that you guys have. So the thing is, as UniPlaces grew, so the monolith grew, and well, Miguel just joined and they told Miguel, hey, so we have your first challenge. We have everything running there, the data layer and core and whatnot, and we want to break this into different virtual machines because they're separated stuff. And Miguel ended up with this. So basically he had two stacks of virtual machines that were provisioned by Vagrant and configured by Ansible. And then Miguel is asked to start working on his first project. And the first project just says that, okay, I'm going to start taking a little bit of the domain context from core and putting it on project number one. So as Miguel does test-driven development, he starts doing his tests, starts working on his project locally. But it comes a time on which he wants to run the tests from the domain that he removed from core back into to see if everything is working as expected, right? So unit tests, integration tests, functional tests, whatever. And then it comes to the point on which, okay, I have a stack of VMs for the data layer, a stack of VMs for core, and I'll probably also need one for project number one. So Miguel ends up with three virtual machines. And you guys can see he gets a little bit sad, like small tear in his eyes. And why is that? So running virtual machines is really cool, and it works. The thing is that every time you provision a virtual machine, typically you need to allocate specific resources from your machine. So it's either memory, it's either CPU, it's either hard drive. And what was happening to Miguel is that he had too much memory provisions. So around 30 to 40% of his memory was allocated just for him to work on this. And the biggest problem is that his machine was starting to get really slow. But okay, he could still work on it. So he delivers project number one, and then he's invited to start working on project number two. So as you guys can see, the monolith is getting a little bit smaller. So he's taking a little bit of context from core again and putting it into the second project. And do you guys want to guess what happens? Yes, so basically what happened is that now we had four virtual machines because Miguel was developing on project number two and the same thing happened on which he only had three, right? He only had three virtual machines running and it was a little bit slow, but then it came to the point on which he needed another one. So he had to, as he had to run tests that would call, for example, project number one, he had to launch a new virtual machine. And now Miguel, he gets really sad. Because now he's even slower. He just wants to work on his projects. He wants to be productive. He wants to work on the next big thing, on the next project. And then someone says, hey, the requirements for project two changed a little bit, and I need you to start to develop this new feature that will need you to make a request to project number three. And project number three is introduced the same way that project number one and project number two were launched. Miguel gets the fifth virtual machine running, and this is the time on which he starts having problems with VMs failing, out of memory, black screens of death, and yeah, he gets really sad. He wants to quit. He's to the point at which he's so frustrating because it takes a lot of time to provision each of these environments. Because let's say that he left work, or he just wants to launch an entire stack. If it takes like 30 minutes per VM or 10 minutes per VM, this is 15 minutes of work. This is not a coffee break. This is like a lunch hour that he's losing. So, and there's another thing. Miguel had a really cool laptop because he joined. He got a new laptop, really cool company policy. But developers that were there longer, they had older laptops. So this was impossible for them. This was really, really bad. Not to mention that this is not modular, right? When he wants to launch something, if he wants to change branch within his project, he needs to do everything all over again, the way that it was set up. So Miguel is not a quitter, right? And he starts thinking, well, maybe I need to improve this. I need to change this. This needs to change. I still remember when my life was easy and was very, very cool when I joined, and this is just a mess. I don't want to work in this. And he starts thinking about ways to solve this problem. So he identifies a problem. So the problem that he has is it's not actually that he's running five virtual VMs, virtual machines. It's a problem that the resources that he has are not enough. But if we come to think about it, probably they're not optimized, right? We have the same stack all over in five different VMs just for nothing. So maybe we should use less resources in the way that we're solving this problem. Maybe we should maximize as well or optimize them. And I also want to be able to run this modularly. I want to say I want to spin up this project and that project, and I don't want to launch more than one VM. So Miguel thought, okay, I want to get back to the basics, and how do I do this? Miguel remembers that when he joins and that this stack, it runs Nginx, right? So Nginx is really cool. It has a lot of advantages. It's very lightweight compared to Apache. I'm not saying it's better, but it is. And he thinks, okay, maybe I can take advantage of this, and maybe I could go back to this. This is what I wanted in the beginning, and it worked. So why, if I broke down the monolith, why cannot get back to it? So he goes back to Nginx. So he thinks about it. So Nginx, what does it do? It's a web server that is very lightweight, and that has a couple of interesting things that Apache also does, which is this. So within Nginx, you can have multiple VOs running in the same machine, and you can have different application channels, right? So for example, if you want to go to students.uniplaces.com or landlords.uniplaces.com, you can go to the same server, and the same server will know based on the server name that it has a specific VO, that has a specific application channel, and it will send it there. So if we have a user there that wants to go, for example, to project one, he just types on his laptop that he wants to go to project one. It resolves to this Nginx server, and it will send it to the appropriate channel. So back to the whiteboards, Miguel also remembers something. So another problem that he had was that every time I want to build my projects, either the NPM that I'm using is broken locally, or I'm using an outdated version of Bower, something like that. And he thinks, okay, maybe with this, I can take advantage of another technology that appeared. And this might seem a little bit of a bottleneck, but it actually solves a lot of problems for our developers because of inconsistencies between versions of software. So Miguel decided to do this, to add this extra layer. So you guys heard a lot about this in the last probably 4 years or so, but Docker is actually not new. Docker, what it does, it takes advantage of something that exists in Linux for probably for more than 15 years, 20 years, which is Linux containers. But they do something really well, which is they make it easy for you guys to use it. And that's the biggest advantage. There were some talks, probably on the keynote, you guys heard the presentation on Docker. And the thing with Docker here is that we know exactly what we're going to run inside these VMs in order to build our projects. And this can be done per project as well. So let's say that I have a specific NPM version for project one and a specific NPM version for project two. When I run the command to build my project, as I'm going to specify which environment I want, I have the Docker file there that builds the Docker and builds my project. So it's perfect. I won't have any pains. So this is just the Docker rail. You guys can see that it's very related to Maersk, the way they transport their stuff. So basically, what did you do? We ended up with this, right? So we ended up with this, and we encapsulated everything within a single VM. And this actually saved a lot of stuff, a lot of troubles. And it also allowed for something else, which is we now have minimal configuration for this, right? We only have one VM that only needs to be provisioned once. Because let's say that we have an update on a Vagrant file that launches my VM, or even to the Ansible to add a new resource to my VM, I don't need to do Vagrant destroy, which is what we did before, and Vagrant start. So and that's like 5 to 10 minutes at least. Basically, what I do Vagrant provision, and it's seconds. It's just installing that and it's done. So this is what we have now and what we had then. So well, before we had a very elaborated setup, but now it's easy. Before it was very resource intensive, and now it's optimized because I launched 2 gigs of a VM with 2 gigs, and I only need that. I don't need to launch anything else. I know that those 2 gigs are going to be more than enough for whatever I want to do. It's very quick to launch. Before, as I said, we had developers taking 3 hours on board. It's not acceptable. It is modular now, so I can launch whatever projects I want, and I won't have a resource bottleneck because of that, because I'm taking advantage of Nginx that will just serve my request to my application. And it's very easy to swap between projects. I just need to change to my other project and start working within it. Or if I'm developing locally, I just need to do a checkout to the next branch and start working on that feature. Then again, just as local environments had problems versus the remote environments, there are also known issues. So these are probably the most common issues that we ran into this setup that I'll just show you guys in a little bit. And they're related to this. So I/O performance can be sometimes tricky, especially running the Dockers to build the project. It was way worse in the past, where they had this weird file system that didn't behave that well. Now they have overlay version 2, which is it's more robust and works. Performing custom matter requests can be tricky. And what does this mean? This means that, for example, we had Nginx serving everything, but we needed something to pass that request into Nginx. So we solved this with ngrok. So ngrok, we just can just understand the request is being done and send it to Nginx with a proper host header. And everything will be sent into the correct channel. Misconfiguration can also cause issues with unclear errors. So we had a developer, or I guess two, that had some really weird issues. Because we had this pretty README file on which they can just follow the steps, and it was bulletproof. It would work all the time. So we thought it's a basic mistake or assumption that we did. And basically what happened was, for example, they had on their etc hosts, they didn't have localhost pointing to 1.7.0.1 loopback. And they weren't able to mount the NFS mount points for Vagrant to use. Also, there were also some problems with devs not being up to date with master on Vagrant. And there was also this weird issue with NTP, which is solved in later versions of VirtualBox that they have. And what would happen is that if you have, for example, a token time-based authentication and you're developing locally, let's say that you generate a token to access a specific system. So you go to your authentication and say, hey, give me a token. I want to access here. And it provides you the token with the wrong timestamp. You go here and it doesn't work. This is also fixed now. And it's demo time or fail time, we'll see. I guess everything will be all right. So what do I want to show you guys first? So basically, what I want to show you is that, for example, I already cloned the Playground project, and this is it. Doesn't seem much. I'm going to open it. So it's fail time. And there we go. So this is the Playground. I'm just opening it here so you guys can see what's it all about. I'm not going to be able to zoom it in, I guess. Sorry about that. So basically, what we have here, we have the Vagrant file, which has all the configurations to my VM, right? The way that I want to configure it. And then I have the parameters file, which basically it's all the parameters that I want to pass into my base configuration. And you guys can see it as like the variables that we're passing into the Vagrant file to launch my VM. Also, in this project, I have everything that's related to Ansible, which is the provisioner that we're using along with Vagrant. And you guys can see that it's very simple. What I'm going to do, I'm going to run all these roles with the super user, and I'm going to install, for example, Git and Ginx, Nginx, PHP, whatever. And for example, if I go here to Git, just to give you a little peek of how easy this is, this will install you Git. For example, Nginx will be configured. You can just say to include the install file, and it has all the steps that you need to configure your Nginx, which is very easy, as you guys can see. So I want to remove SSL. I want to create the SSL folder now. I want to copy the certificates that I'm using for my dev environment. I want to set up the user, et cetera. Okay? So all of that is here. So now we're going to the sort of demo part of this presentation. And I say it's sort of a demo because I did something in the past before creating the presentation, which was I recorded how we provisioned the virtual machine because it still takes 5 minutes on the first time. So the next couple of times, it takes seconds. It's really, really quick. So I used TT-REC to record this, and I'm going to use TT-Play to play it for you guys. So this is what I was running, right? So I created the base folder for Microsoft Open Source Camp. I added my GitHub key because I wanted to clone Playground, right? And I cloned it. Boom, really easy. Then I go to Playground, and what I need to do is go to that file that I told you guys, the vagrant params YAML file, which basically will allow me to say, where are my repositories? Where are my projects, right? The projects that I really want to use. So it's the only configuration that I typically need to change, but I can also change memory, CPU, and also change the IP for my NFS shares. If you guys have any questions, you let me know. So now I just add my private key to the agent because this will allow me to SSH into the Vagrant server after it's launched. So I'm just going to speed this up a little bit. As you guys can see, it's asking me for administration privileges. It's the only time it asks for that because we need to mount my repositories within the virtual machine, right? And here comes, as you guys can see, it comes Ansible. Ansible is here. It's provisioning everything for me now. You guys can see if it fails in one of these steps, it's really easy to understand where. So it also helps you to troubleshoot where the problem might exist. So I'm just going to speed up this a little bit. Okay. And then I just entered the server here and listed what's there, but I guess we can do that. So if I do Vagrant SSH. Yeah. It's fail time. it's here. I'm already there, actually. So how does this work? So I'm going to spoil it for you guys. So we have some alias that help the developers to run the commands that you need, right? So I don't want the developer to know how to launch a Docker, how to deal with the Docker. I just want him to as easily as possible, to build his own projects. And I have all my projects here, right? So if I go there, for example, and I go to UniPlace's AP, I can just do docker ap npm install. And basically what this does, and I'm just going to stop this guy here. No, it's not going to stop. Basically what this does, this is launching a Docker that has everything it needs to build to use npm install on this project. So the developer doesn't need to know what's there. Of course, if he wants to, I think it's added value that we provide to the developers, but he doesn't need to know that. And as you guys can see, he runs one command, just as he was running locally, npm install, and it will install everything there. So I think we have 5 minutes. So I'm going to go to Q&A because it's probably a lot of information. And I'm just gonna continue with the presentation. But I'm more than happy to show you guys in the end of this talk if you guys want to see it working or some more information about it. But basically also, what I just want to show as well is you guys can see that Nginx is running. I have I have all my views here, right? So I have, these are our PHP platforms. It's Ops, SPA, Core, Admin, etc. And what Nginx will do is, it'll receive a request from myself, and it'll go to the shared folder that has my build project, and it will send it back to me. So for example, I've already did this before, but what I have is, in my etc/os file, I have it all set up here, right? So for example, I want to access SPA. So I just go here. It's missing the rest of the URL, which is here. And basically what this doing is sending Nginx a request. Nginx goes to my folder, it knows the application channel, it builds whatever it needs to send it back to me, and I receive it here. So this is actually my local environment, my local dev environment, and it seems like everything is working as expected. Also, a cool trick that we can do is we use Grunt, and you guys can see Grunt here. So this also helps developers with compiled assets that on which they might be working on. So they, as soon as they save the file, it's compiled and it's available for them. So this was the demo time. So next steps for this. So we usually now still provision etc/os manually. This could be very easily done through some script that provisions that, or even via Ansible. We want to add Uniplaces Playground to all the projects. So as this is the web track, we only show the PHP project that we have, but we also use Golang. So for example, we want to have all of these to be used by the Golang projects. We want to have some kind of support, or start thinking about support for remote environments as well. So if you're developing locally and you have microservices running on some instance in the clouds that you guys don't want to run locally, that's one of the next steps that we have for this project. And we'll probably be doing a blog post on this, on our blog post. So you guys ask, where's the blog post? And it's on this URL. So it's geeks.uniplaces.com. And this is it. Time for questions if you have them.